It is Tuesday, July 16th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Waltzen Family Charitable Support Foundation. The 15th annual KUAF Summer Jazz Series continues with the Composer's Showcase, the music of Rick Salonen, at Walden Arts Center Star Theater on Saturday, July 27th. This performance will present the compositions and arrangements of Dr. Rick Salonen, performed by duos, trios, quartets, and quintets from local jazz artists, including the 18-piece Fayetteville Jazz Collective. Tickets and more information are available online at KUAF.com.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, using a view from the sky to figure out what might happen next underground. Jonathan Reeves reports on how airplanes are being used to tell what the new Madrid Fault in Arkansas might be doing. Plus, a smoldering fire at a sawmill poses some interesting questions.
And an art collection in the middle of Springdale you may not know about. Christina Thomas walks us through the paintings, sculptures, and more at Tyson headquarters. And our history doctor, Bill Smith, tells us that spying is in the news now and has been part of the American landscape since before 1776.
But first, yesterday was the first day on the job for the new president and CEO of Arkansas Children's Hospital. Marcy Doderer started her career as an intern at the hospital in 1987, working under then CEO Randall O'Donnell. Most recently, she was administrator of Children's Hospital of San Antonio. She says she's glad to be back in her home state leading Arkansas Children's Hospital.
My goal for the first 90 to 100 days is really to spend time listening to the team of Arkansas Children's Hospital, our employees, our physicians, our board, community leaders, and other supporters of the hospital to help me form a really nice picture of what works very well in our facility and what the vision of the community is for our facility as we move forward over the next decade.
Doderer replaces longtime CEO Dr. John Bates, who retired last month.
Officials with the Arkansas Workers' Compensation Commission say the commission's office in either Springdale or Fort Smith will soon close. The closure is meant to help counteract a $135 million unfunded liability in its death and permanent disability trust fund. The fund services benefits to families of workers killed or permanently injured on the job after a certain deductible is met by workers' compensation insurance providers. AWCC Chairman Watson Bell says turbulent economic times have contributed to the trust fund shortfall.
We don't get any general revenue. We are what's called a special revenue agency. All we get is what we bring in. And what our revenue is a premium tax that comes from the people who pay workers' comp. And when that tax goes down, our revenue stream goes down. And we're basically, our gross income is basically the same as it was 13 years ago. So you can see we've got a financial situation that we're having to deal with, and we're having to make some tough decisions.
Bell says the commission has three offices in the state, and the Little Rock office handles roughly three-quarters of the workers' compensation cases in the state, with the Springdale and Fort Smith offices handling the remaining 25% to 30% of cases. Bell says the decision on which office will be closed will be made soon, but a decision will only be made after weighing a number of factors.
We're looking at several things. Of course, the caseload, one, location, the existing facilities that we could move people to. No one's going to lose their job in regard to this move. We're just going to have people go to one of the offices or the other. So we're looking at a variety of things, travel time, that sort of thing.
Bell says since 2000, the Workers' Compensation Commission has reduced staff numbers from 154 employees to 105 employees because of the shortfall in revenue. But those staff cuts were made using attrition rather than layoffs.
Several candidates running in the 2014 election have filed fundraising reports for the second quarter of this year with the Federal Election Commission. For his bid for re-election to the U.S. Senate, Senator Mark Pryor has raised $1.2 million and reports having $3.92 million on hand. Meanwhile, 4th District Representative Tom Cotton reports raising just more than $611,000 for the quarter and having just over $1 million on hand. 3rd District Representative Steve Womack reports raising nearly $229,000 during the second quarter quarter and reports having $579,000 on hand. None of those three candidates are currently opposed for their reelection bids. However, independent groups have spent several thousand dollars opposing certain candidates. Two groups, the Patriot Majority USA PAC and Senate Majority PAC, have collectively spent more than $300,000 running advertising campaigns in opposition to Tom Cotton. Two other groups, the Club for Growth and Senate Conservatives, have collectively spent more than $500,000 opposing Senator Mark Pryor. And in the race for the governor's office, Democrat Mike Ross leads in fundraising with nearly $2 million raised and $1.7 million cash on hand. Republican gubernatorial hopeful Asa Hutchinson is reporting $379,000 raised.
New sanitation rates are taking effect for Fort Smith residents. According to the city, the first set of utility bills reflecting the 7.7% reduction in sanitation rates were mailed to residential customers last Thursday. Residents should expect to pay about $1.10 less for sanitation services on their monthly utility bill. The rate reduction was a result of cost savings by the city's switch to fully mechanized trash collection throughout the city. The rate decrease was approved by the city's board of directors in May, and at that time, city sanitation director Bayardi Nokokaley said he expected the decreased rates to last for about 2 years. Because the utility bills are mailed in batches throughout the month, residents on the city's south side will be the last to see the reduced rates.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals may be beginning to turn their luck around. They won a game last night, the second of a four-game stretch on the road. The Nats beat the Tulsa Drillers in Oklahoma 3-2. Play will continue tonight in Tulsa.
With the hot, dry summer weather setting in across Arkansas, 25 counties are under burn bans. In the northwestern corner of the state, only Benton, Washington, Crawford, Franklin, Sebastian, and Logan counties are not under burn bans. Mostly cloudy tonight with a slight chance of showers with lows in the upper 60s. Mostly sunny tomorrow with highs from the lower to mid-90s throughout the listening area. And partly cloudy tomorrow night with lows from 66 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 71 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Fire has been smoldering in southeastern Carroll County for over a year. The cause is a phenomenon more than a century old. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this report.
Osage, Arkansas was the first town settled in Carroll County. It had an apothecary, doctor's office, several sawmills, and Stamps General Store constructed in 1901. The two-story limestone block building still stands and operates as Osage Clay Works, run by Potter Newt Lale and his spouse Amy McGeehee. Together, they produce lovely emerald green, cobalt blue, and buff-colored stoneware jugs, urns, cups, mugs, and plates.
My name is Newton Lale, and you're in downtown Osage, Arkansas. Osage, Arkansas is a quaint little community just barely off of U.S. 412, about an hour east of Fayetteville.
And the population?
It's on a growth spurt because the preacher's wife had a baby. That got us to 20. The widow woman down the street got married. That got us to 21. I live in the most wonderful little community in that we know everybody and you help everybody when it's necessary.
We step outside on the front porch. The fragrance of burning wood hangs in the cool morning air.
Barely. The day is not a bad day. But there are days when you will see smoke coming up over the hill. You'll definitely smell it. My wife has asthma. That is one of the big reasons that we need to find a solution to this problem, because she doesn't need to breathe it.
Some days, Lale says, the smoke is on you, meaning a dense haze has settled over your place. Other days are clear. The source of this smoke is less than a mile away at Osage Sawmill, high up on a bluff, overlooking Osage Valley.
The fire was started by a lightning strike 4 o'clock in the morning. I heard it, but I didn't know where it struck. I did walk around my property just looking, do we have anything amiss, and there was nothing. But by daybreak, I smelled the smoke, and I knew something, but I didn't think to go up to the sawmill. And somebody by 8 o'clock saw it and called it in, and that's when the fire department became involved.
That was last July, says Lale, who is also president of the South Carroll County Rural Fire Association. The abandoned mill held acres of slab wood and mountains of sawdust.
There was a lot of slabs to be burned that either we had to set them on fire or they were going to gradually catch on. So we made the decision, we got the forestry department involved, and we burned those slabs. But today, all that's left is the remains of the sawdust. And the sawdust, because it's a pile of dust, you need oxygen to make it burn, or you got to smother it. And we got neither. We got a smoldering sawdust fire.
Smoldering for over a year, impairing the air, placing this tiny mountain community at risk. After the fire, property owner Wayne McNair and his brother reopened the sawmill, cutting railroad ties and lumber, employing a half dozen laborers, Lale says. Good for the local economy. Newton Lale says the neighbors are not mad at Wayne McNair. They seek a cooperative solution to this problem. We managed to reach Wayne McNair by phone, but he said he was too busy to talk. Return calls were not answered. But allowing sawmill dust piles to smolder on the Ozarks, says Carroll County Judge Sam Barr, is a long time common practice.
Back in the 60s, early 70s, I had a sawmill. Most of your logs that you saw are freshly cut when you bring them in there, and when you saw them, the sawdust from them are wet. And when it piles up and piles, well, it heats down in that pile. And if it ever gets afar, there's not much way putting it out unless you can spread it out enough where it can finally burn out.
Part of the problem, Barr suspects, is that the operator accumulated too much sawdust on one spot.
If you can keep the pile small from the start, you'll probably never have this problem. If you do, you could put it out. But when it has excessive amount of sawdust in these piles, there ain't much way to put it out.
Judge Barr says the responsibility falls to the landowner. But Wayne McNair is doing what's always been done, letting the 40-foot-high sawdust pile slowly burn out. But according to Catherine Beninati at the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality, it's not okay. In an email for this report, she said no record exists on Osage Sawmill, and they've not received any complaints. The agency plans to dispatch an air and solid waste inspector this week to assess the situation. Now, an official with the Arkansas Forestry Commission says unless the fire threatens other property, there's nothing they can do either to quell it. Chief of the fire department at Berryville, which is the largest, closest town, declined talking on tape but said they've responded to fires at Osage Sawmill on numerous occasions. Back in the spring of 2003, a smoldering sawdust pile triggered a massive fire at the sawmill. Five fire departments responded, hauling 28 truckloads of water. A track hoe was brought in to pull apart the burning pile and douse it. So after the July 4th, 2012 lightning strike, rural firefighters opted to do a controlled burn of the abandoned debris on site to prevent another catastrophic fire. But they didn't expect the sawdust pile to burn this long. And now that the sawmill is back in business, a new huge mountain of bright orange fresh oak sawdust can be seen rising on the mountain bluff from the highway below. Newton Lale.
The new is on the very top. The old is on the very bottom. And if we could get closer, you would see large burns, portions where it has burned. And then there's almost prehistoric looking, formations that hasn't burned yet. And it's just the situation needs to be stirred up, dug out, got to do something. I kept hoping that give it time, it'll just burn out. Give it a little more time, it'll burn out. But like I said, we're pushing a year here, and we still got lots of fuel left to burn there.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Because of a lack of rain, burn bans have been placed on at least 23 Arkansas counties. The United States Drought Monitor says portions of the state are in moderate drought.
This is Ozarks at Large. Scientists are in the new Madrid Seismic Zone, a region that includes parts of Arkansas, Missouri, and Tennessee, trying to understand what causes earthquakes there. In order to conduct that research, surveys are actually being conducted in the air. Jonathan Reeves from our content partner KASU explains in this report.
The United States Geological Survey is using an airplane to gather clues about earthquakes in the New Madrid seismic zone. Through the end of July, the USGS will make low-level flights over a 1,400-square-mile area that includes Blytheville and Piggott, Arkansas, Kennett and Kulin, Missouri, as well as other parts of northeast Arkansas, southeast Missouri, and western Tennessee. Geophysicist Dr. Richard Blakely is leading the project. He tells about it.
Yes, well, we're going to be flying a single-engine small airplane at low altitude, relatively low, back and forth along lines that are spaced only 400 meters apart, and the flight will be flown at about 650 feet above the ground, back and forth, in order to measure the magnetic field of the Earth at that low altitude.
The airplane that will be used is a single-engine Cessna that will have a magnetometer, which will measure the magnetic field of the Earth without emitting any energy or signal of its own. Dr. Blakely says this kind of research is done primarily in the western United States.
We've been doing this kind of research in the past a lot. Speaking for myself, I've been working a great deal in the Pacific Northwest, and we find this a good way to find contacts between rocks that are somewhat more magnetic than the rocks next to that. For example, if a fault brings together a relatively magnetic rock, like a volcanic rock, against a low magnetic rock, like a sediment, we can detect that with sensitive instruments in the air. And so we can map these contacts over distances, even though the faults may not be exposed at the topographic surface.
For the last 40 years, the New Madrid area has been the most seismically active region in the United States, east of the Rocky Mountains. Several hundred earthquakes happen every year along the seismic zone, which stretches from Arkansas and Tennessee north through Missouri and parts of western Kentucky and southern Illinois. Why earthquakes happen in that area is a mystery to scientists. Geophysicist Rob Williams is with the U.S. Geological Survey and is working with Dr. Blakely on this research. Williams tells what makes the New Madrid area different from fault lines, such as the San Andreas Fault in California.
The cause of earthquakes in that region is not well understood. So we know we have this history of earthquakes. It's an active seismic zone today. 1811, 1812, you had the big sequence of earthquakes and aftershocks, and then at least two other sequences before that in the last couple thousand years of big earthquakes. But it's somewhat of a mystery as to the cause of earthquakes in the New Madrid seismic zone. It is more active than most areas of the eastern U.S., but it's a bit of a puzzle about why this particular zone is more active than the areas surrounding the region. So when you go to California and you see this plate boundary along the San Andreas Fault between the North American plate and the Pacific plate, and the fault is grinding past each other there, the two plates, we come into the interior of the continent in North America, and we don't have this plate tectonic explanation to help us understand the earthquake.
That's because the New Madrid seismic zone is actually located in the middle of the North American plate and consists of numerous fractures that cause earthquakes. Williams tells what characteristics the zone has that may cause the tremors.
It contains, in that area, though, a long history of geologic history that where we've had a lot of different episodes of faulting and rifting over millions of years. So within the New Madrid seismic zone, it does have somewhat unique character in terms of millions of years ago, it was an old rift zone where the continent began to tear apart and then somewhat healed itself. So there is this old ancient faults out there that may be weak zones that are susceptible to the stresses that do reach into the middle of the continent.
And large sequences of earthquakes have been recorded in the region going back as far as 2300 BC. Dr. Richard Blakely says about every 500 years, major earthquakes of the magnitude of 7 or 8 have struck the region, with the last major earthquakes taking place in the winter of 1811 and 1812. Even though the area was lightly populated at the time, the earthquakes caused major damage and were felt as far away as the East Coast, where it was reported President John Adams felt the first earthquake on December 16, 1811, and also recorded that he felt the second earthquake in January 1812 in Washington, D.C. A third earthquake happened in February 1812, which was also felt along the eastern seaboard. Williams says officials fear another major series of earthquakes could hit the region in the area that is now home to several million people. Dr. Richard Blakely says the goal of the survey is to try to understand what causes the seismic activity of the area, with the hopes of eventually being able to predict when the next big earthquake could happen. Blakely says flights along the area are expected to take place through the rest of this month. He tells what they'll be looking for when they pour through the accumulated data from the survey.
We fly back and forth along these very closely spaced flight lines and measuring magnetic fields along these flight lines. So we end up with lots and lots of numbers representing the magnetic field. Ultimately, we produce maps of the magnetic field, brightly colored maps that have on them, we call them anomalies, where the magnetic field is slightly above or slightly below so-called normal levels. Those maps are in a way a proxy for the geology that's beneath the surface. So we use these maps to try to draw geologic contacts, including faults. We model these magnetic anomalies to try to get a feeling for the three-dimensional characteristics of the contacts beneath the surface. And it's a process that goes on for some time.
Dr. Blakely says it will take several months to pour through the data, and the final results from the survey could be released next summer.
Jonathan Reeves from our content partner KASU filed that report for Ozarks at Large from Jonesboro. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The Ronald McDonald Family Room at Mercy Hospital had a grand opening this morning. It's the first family room in Northwest Arkansas. The family room is located on the third floor of Mercy Hospital, and it's designed to provide respite and relaxation during an otherwise stressful situation while keeping loved ones near their ill child. While private bedrooms are part of the overall design, communal sitting areas, a large dining room, and family play area are included to encourage bonding and discussions between families as they build their network of support.
Okay, now I've got a lot of information about this next item.
Okay.
And I'm going to have a web address at the end.
Okay.
All right. There will be free ticket vouchers for 3,000 free backpacks that are going to be filled with age-appropriate school supplies for children in kindergarten through 12th grade. They're going to be distributed through the Springdale and Rogers Samaritan Community Center and their market pantries. Now, market days at the Springdale Samaritan Center are Tuesday and Thursday. In Rogers Market, they're Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. The tickets for the backpacks are only available through the markets and only during the market hours of 9 to 11 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Those tickets are going to be distributed on a first-come, first-served basis through July 25th or until all 3,000 tickets are gone. There are no income qualifications to receive a backpack through the Samaritan Community Center's annual Backpacks for Kids programs, but you do need to have the voucher.
Okay.
And also, school supplies without backpacks are available to children who are homeschooled. All backpacks now will be distributed during the Backpacks for Kids Day, Saturday, July 27th. They're going to be at three different locations from 10 until 1 that day at the Springdale Samaritan Community Center, at the Rogers Samaritan Community Center, and at the Gravett Church of Christ on Irving Street in Gravett. All right? That's a lot of information.
It is.
All of that can be found, all that information and more, at the website samcc.org. Thanks, Samaritan Community Center, samcc.org.
All right. The 11th annual Summer Salsa benefiting EOA Children's House of Springdale. You were part of this event.
I was the MC for that
right?
night, yes.
Mm-hmm. was the most successful to date. They had more than 300 people in attendance and a total of $96,400 raised. The evening's Fill the Tank auction appeal raised $12,546 to support the daily transportation services EOA Children's House provides to bring the children to and from the Pat Walker Center for Children in Springdale. What was Fill the Tank?
Fill the Tank was an appeal because so many of these children who benefit from Children's House live not in Springdale. They might live in Pea Ridge or Prairie Grove, and there's transportation that picks them up every day and brings them back.
Oh, okay.
So the idea there was to raise money to help pay for the transportation.
I was wondering if it was one of those things where they had like a tank that people tossed change in or something at the event. Okay,
no,
I'm with you.
It was just, you know, if you've been to a fundraiser, cards on the table.
Oh, yes, cards on the table. Okay.
And that money specifically goes for the gasoline.
I'm with you.
All right.
Well, congratulations to them.
Yes. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Edward Snowden, spying and American history. Our history Dr. Bill Smith says the United States has been spying on other countries since before the U.S. even existed, and other countries have been returning the favor. A brief history of spying ahead in about 3 minutes on Ozarks at Large.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, a conversation with a former Lehman Brothers banker who is starting his new life as a doctor.
I can say that what I did greatly impacted the life or lifestyle of another human being directly, whereas working in finance, kind of the end result is more money in somebody's pocket.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now this afternoon at 1 o'clock right after Ozarks at Large.
It is Tuesday, July 16th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Okay, this is about as far from yesterday as we can get.
Okay.
It's still music.
Okay.
But we're going to talk about the Vans Warped Tour.
Fun.
Which is all over the area. Our music writer, Kevin Kinder, has pointed this out as part of our coverage of events in the region.
Yes.
Hawthorne Heights will be performing, Reliant K.
Really?
303, All-Star Weekend, and many more. All-day concerts, multiple stages, lots of music. It's at the, I guess it's now the Cricket Wireless Amphitheater in Kansas City on July 23rd.
Okay.
July 24th at the Verizon Wireless Amphitheater in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And August 2nd at the Gexa Energy Pavilion in Dallas. And you can find out more at VansWarpedTour.com. If you're interested in other music, Widespread Panic is in Dallas on Wednesday at the Verizon Theater at Grand Prairie. Kid Rock is at the Gexa Energy Pavilion on Saturday. American Idol Live at the Verizon Theater at Grand Prairie on the 27th. Brad Paisley at the Gexa Energy Pavilion. If somebody knows if I'm saying that wrong, please let me know. July 27th. In Tulsa, 1964, the tribute. They'll be there Friday at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Billy Idol is at the Hard Rock Casino on the 25th in Tulsa. And New Kids on the Block, Sunday at the Sprint Center in Kansas City.
So lots of choices and lots of different places.
And you can check that out every week in What's Up on Friday.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. Recently, stop the presses. We are shocked to find out that the United States spies on other countries. Here to help us figure out if this has ever happened before, I think I know the answer, is our history Dr. Bill Smith. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
One of the impacts is the revelation that we, the U.S., gather intelligence on the members of the G8.
Again, not unique to this era.
But many would argue that we should be above this.
Well, remember, George Washington was not only the father of our country, the commander of the colonial army, but he was also our first spy master.
Okay. I'm going to defend George here a little bit, because that was a time of war when we were trying to get our independence. You got to give him some slack for spying then, right?
Well, okay. Let's put it into a time of peace and let's give it some framework somewhat like the G8.
Mm-hmm.
How about the Washington Naval Conference in the 1920s, the 20th century forerunner of 21st century problems and ideas if there ever was one?
Okay, I may be the only one hearing your voice that doesn't remember this, but for my benefit, help me out with the Washington Naval Conference. I don't remember that right off the top of my head.
Well, let's remember that technology isn't something that Al Gore invented along with the internet.
Okay.
Since Samuel Morse developed digital communications in the 1800s and Alexander Graham Bell added voice to wire, we have used technology to defeat time and distance in our communications.
Sure.
Okay? So coming out of the First World War, there's a couple of things happening. Number one, a great commitment globally to avoid the horror that was the First World War, and let's do that by limiting arms. Right. Does that sound very latter 20th century-ish? Mm-hmm. And the other, that we need to know what's happening on the other side. We had experienced it ourselves with the Zimmerman telegram dropped on us by the British, and we had decided as a nation it was time for the United States to create a special agency designed to detect and decode the messages of foreign countries. Located within the State Department, it was officially known as the Cipher Bureau or the Black Chamber, as it became known later. This became a factor in one of the first major arms limitation treaty negotiations in the world, which was the Washington Naval Conference.
Okay, okay.
So the desire of the world was to stop those horrors of the trench and the perceived unprecedented killing of the First World War. If nations could limit the strategic weapons of the day, gigantic ships bristling with cannons that were known both as battleships and dreadnoughts, even bigger than battleships, the chance of another global war might be reduced.
This, okay, go back to when we were adolescents and you had the SALT talks, right? Strategic arms limitation talks. And that was to, if we limit the nuclear capabilities of everybody, we can't blow ourselves up.
Yes. Yeah, so quite literally, if you substitute nuclear weapon for battleship, you get a pretty clear analogy.
Now bring me back into spies. You were talking about spies earlier.
All right. The Black Chamber intercepted and broke the messages of the delegates that were there, particularly the Japanese, who were the rising power of the day.
Quite a concern.
Yes. England and the United States wanted to limit Tokyo's ability to build a modern navy. What was being negotiated was a reduction in the number of battleships for everyone to limit the size and number and in relation or proportion to other nations. This is where the work of the Cipher Bureau comes into play.
Okay.
They were able to see that the Japanese negotiators, talking back to their government in Tokyo, had come to a point how far they would go before they just walked. Obviously, in negotiation, if you know how far your opponent's going to go, that's a major coup.
Sure.
So, in tapping these communications, we understand that the proportion that we can push the Japanese to in relation to these other two countries is 5-5-3. The Royal Navy in the U.S. would be the fives, and the Imperial Navy would be the much smaller three.
In hindsight, it looks like that was, you know, time well spent.
And it was. And as many would say later, that we managed to somehow convince the Japanese to accept a Rolls-Royce, Rolls-Royce, and Ford navies.
Okay, so can you draw a line between this Black Chamber and the NSA?
Well, not directly.
Okay.
The discovery later by Henry L. Stimson, serving as Secretary of State for Herbert Hoover, will end the Cipher Bureau and the Black Chamber. He shut it down, ending Americans' cryptography operations in the State Department in 1929, famously making the quote that gentlemen do not read each other's mail.
Well, perhaps gentlemen don't.
Yes. Well, perhaps it was an echo in his mind back to the intercepting of mail and telegraphic messages done by the British, and that pushed us in some ways
into
that great war. The irony, though, is that when Hoover leaves, and he returns later to public service in 1940 as Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of War, there was no squeamishness at all in using code breaking and other signal interception techniques against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Well, exactly. This is all very interesting. Get me to how this relates to Edward Snowden.
Well, on the surface, it doesn't. Snowden himself relates more to Daniel Ellsberg and the release of the Pentagon Papers.
Mm-hmm.
The cases have a lot of similarities. Daniel Ellsberg was working for Rand Corporation. People sometimes forget that. Government contractor.
Right.
When he made the decision to reveal the project he was working on, what became known as the Pentagon Papers was a collection of documents and internal history of what America had done in relation to the war in Vietnam and how they had portrayed deliberately things to the American people. They revealed that the Defense Department had determined the war was unwinnable, and some of the misdirection used to hide this fact and other important details about the war from the American public.
But now, hasn't Daniel Ellsberg commended Snowden for his leaking?
Well, and this is one of those unique moments in American history when the past can directly connect to the present. And as a result, we should be careful about inferring exactly where that leads us in the future. Let's consider. Do we believe that any sophisticated nation would not already be aware of our ability to look into their communications?
Right.
We kept our optical surveillance capabilities in black budgets and top secret cover ever since Edward Land's inventions in photography gave us a little bit more than Polaroid pictures during the Cold War. I'm reminded in particular of Dwight Eisenhower as president, announcing that he wished to have an open skies initiative, that everyone would allow everybody to look at their stuff as a way of confirmation during this ratcheting up of nuclear arms on both sides.
So when you say everyone to look at everyone, every country was completely open.
Correct.
That was his.
That was his idea. We've got nothing to hide. We want to be able to see what you're doing. Sounds a little bit like Ronald Reagan, trust and verify in a future sense. So,
was anyone actually trusting each other, though?
Well, you know, that's sort of the interesting thing about how Eisenhower is going to propose this, and there are a lot of idealists around the world that would accept that. But let's be honest, the Soviet Union, who was built upon the premise of a tremendous amount of secrecy, was not about to agree with that. No how, no way. Did that stop Dwight Eisenhower from following through with open skies? No, not one bit, because it didn't prevent us from first overflying with spy planes, a fact that got famously revealed by the shooting down of a U-2 spy plane in the capture and show trial of its CIA pilot, Francis Gary Powers, and then later satellites that would do the same.
Didn't that all happen right before a major international meeting for the president?
Well, indeed. And if there is our sort of link where Snowden comes back around to this talk about, oh, this is going to hurt the president because he's going to the G8, and now where the G8 knows that we're... Indeed, you have Eisenhower's program to gain better intelligence on just how many nuclear intercontinental ballistic missiles were held by the Soviets being revealed right in front of a major four-power summit in Paris set for May of 1960. As a result, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev would use the event to publicly embarrass Eisenhower and walk out of the talks.
Give me the real takeaway from all of this.
Okay. We exist in two realities. The one that we know, and the one that history will reveal over time. Let's go back to the Washington Naval Conference, where we started this long walk through the woods.
Right.
By having the knowledge that the Japanese would settle for a reduction in battleships and that 5-5-3 proportion, the American negotiators were to get the victory they wanted for military advantage in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. What they gave up, however, proved far more significant. Focused on items that would help create the East Asia co-prosperity sphere, Japan's plan for dominance in what we would today call the Pacific Rim, the Japanese negotiators won from the Americans and the British the concession that military installations that those two nations had in the region could not be further fortified.
Oh.
Thus, in early 1940, the Imperial Japanese Army was able to crush the British at Singapore, and the Americans were forced to abandon Manila for the island of Corregidor and eventually also surrender, leading to the Bataan Death March for the survivors. Mm-hmm. The entire purpose of the conference was rendered moot by changing technology. Focused on refighting the last war, the battleship became nothing more than floating artillery to support invasion in the next war. The two afterthoughts of the treaty, aircraft carriers and submarines, became the decisive naval weapons of the coming war. In the end, knowing the other side's cards didn't necessarily lead to intelligent decisions in the future.
Try to be the smartest person in the room, but don't assume you are.
Exactly.
Well, until they open up the Google time capsule in 2525,
we're history. We'll be right back.
You don't have to travel far from any point in our listening area to see collections of art. There are museums, college campuses, and galleries practically in every populated place, the Tyson Foods headquarters in Springdale included. On the grounds outside and on the walls inside are original works by renowned artists with Arkansas ties, and some without local connections like Andy Warhol and Roy Lichtenstein. Last week, Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas took a tour of the collection and has this report.
As you pull up to the Tyson headquarters on Don Tyson Parkway in Springdale, you'll notice a large bronze sculpture on the front lawn. Birdman is a Native American man on a horse. He's holding an eagle. The sculpture, by Jack Woods, an Arkansas-born artist and friend of Don Tyson, was commissioned by Don Tyson after the untimely death of his half-brother Randall in 1986. Just across the lawn from Birdman is another sculpture, Yokes on the Trail of Tears by Pat Muzak. Works of art are not unique to the exterior of large office buildings or corporate headquarters. Yet these two works are just a hint as to what's inside this building. Dubbed Springdale's Hidden Treasure, these walls hold the 600-piece Tyson corporate art collection. The collection began with Don Tyson, son of the company's founder, John Tyson, and leader of the chicken giant for years. That's according to Archie Schaefer, former executive vice president and today's tour guide.
Don collected for years traditional Western art, and you'll see lots of bronzes, many of them done by Jack Woods, who did the big piece out front. But then a few Remingtons and Russells and others that Don collected, as well as, you know, traditional cowboy art paintings, you know, of cowboys and Western art scenes. And Don started collecting.
136 pieces were collected during the Don Tyson era of collecting up to 1992. His son John got the art collecting bug after becoming familiar with the Louvre in Paris during college in the 1970s. Though he is still very much collecting, his era is said to be from 1992 to 2002, in which 177 pieces were acquired. And since 2002, 202 pieces have been acquired. But that doesn't include the IBP collection. Tyson acquired the Beef and Pork Company in the early 2000s, and along with the company came their art collection of nearly 200 pieces, two of which stand guard in front of the entryway. On either side of a pair of large wooden doors, works of art themselves, rest two Indian sculptures, Iron That Walks and Trophies of Honor. They rest under two skylights. It's like they belonged in the Tyson lobby. And once you're in the lobby, you'll see two George Dombeck paintings. They hang above a couch, which is across from the secretary's desk. Dombeck is an Arkansas artist. He lives in Goshen and is a close friend of the Tysons. From his flowers to a water tower series, the company has at least 60 of his watercolors. And if you take a right at the desk.
There's one. This one is entitled Hello. And it's a big red flower hanging right at the beginning of the hallway going to our executive wing. But Dombeck, you know, goes through these phases where he paints one kind of thing or group of things for a long time. And he went through this period where he painted flowers and water towers and, you know, architectural things. You know, he was trained as an architect. So.
This painting takes us to the Pop Art Hall, which includes apples and the Oval Office by Roy Lichtenstein, Prince of Food by Wayne Thiebaud, works by Richard Diebenkorn, Sam Francis, Robert Motherwell, Helen Frankenthaler, the Robert Indiana Love Series, which many will recognize from stamps with the slanted O, or the sculpture at Crystal Bridges. And then there's a piece by Brendan O'Connell.
About 10 or 12 years ago, decided to not paint anything but scenes inside Walmarts. And so he has become very well known as the Walmart artist. And we commissioned him to do a piece of Tyson products that was based on a photograph taken in a local Walmart store of some of our products in a display case.
The work is of Tyson Anytizers inside a freezer case. Though abstract, the products are easily identified. Brendan O'Connell has been dubbed the Walmart Warhol. And speaking of Andy Warhol, the pop artist has an entire hallway in these headquarters all to himself.
This hallway is dedicated to Andy Warhol. This is the Andy Warhol Cowboys and Indians collection that is 14 serigraphs that show everything from John Wayne to Sitting Bull and Geronimo. And this was, as I said, the first collection that John acquired and installed back in the early 90s. And we moved the artwork around quite a bit, but we have had these here in this one hallway for a long time because it's kind of a landmark for people in the company to tell people, go to the Warhol hallway. And
take a right, you'll see art. Take a left, more art. Hallways run north-south, east-to-west, and almost all are decorated with art. Real art. Much is by Arkansas artists, or those that have a connection to Arkansas. All is done in the 20th century or later, and some are gifts, like Cowmouflage, a sculpture of a cow and a chicken that rests in an atrium connecting two buildings. Cowmouflage was part of the 2001 Kansas City Cow Parade, and since Tyson has expanded to include beef and pork, it seems fitting. A work depicting the pork aspect of the business was also a gift, though this one was anonymous. The piece just appeared on a loading dock, and Schaefer welcomes any help in finding out who gifted it.
It is entitled Slaughterhouse in Terre Haute and was done by an interesting artist named Noel Rockmore, who was not from Arkansas. He was a New York and New Orleans artist that worked in the 50s, 60s, 70s, up to the 90s. I think he died in 1995. But there's kind of a resurgence of interest in Rockmore now. He was a true bohemian, I would say. And the theme of it is you know, it's inside a slaughterhouse with pigs being processed, which is why we assume someone connected to Tyson thought we needed it, but we still haven't quite figured it out.
The large painting is colorful, though it depicts the gory scene inside a slaughterhouse. Nearby is the entrance to the Don Tyson hallway, works from his personal collection. Some pieces even hung in his home.
Hallway that is dedicated to Don's traditional Western art and includes paintings and bronzes. All of the bronzes down this hallway were done by Jack Woods. But for people who like cowboy art, there's some pieces that people will, you know, artists that people will recognize. James Bama, that's a Remington. Frank McCarthy. Frank McCarthy was one of Don's favorite artists, so there's three or four McCarthy paintings, including this one entitled Old Blue Heading Home, which was Don's favorite painting and hung behind his desk in his office for a long time. It's by Charlie Dye.
Archie Schaefer is a longtime executive and friend of the Tysons. He's also part of the four-member team, loosely called the Art Team. His interest in art came after taking an art history class from Don Harrington in the 1990s. That local artist is best known as a writer, but Tyson does have a few prints he did in the 1950s. Schaefer's favorite is one depicting a scene inside George's, the longtime Fayetteville watering hole. Schaefer's office is in the executive wing. You'll notice when you cross that threshold, because the carpet is plush, the walls are lined with Arkansas oak. And behind the secretary's desk, bronzed egg crates. When we reach Schaefer's office, I ask what hangs on his walls.
Three or four Noel Rockmore pieces in it. Also have a Doug Randall painting. Doug Randall's a Fayetteville artist that a lot of people collect Doug's stuff. I have a Russell Cothran photograph. Russell, you know, is a photographer for the U of A that lots of people know. I have one of Russell's photographs. Have a Lenora Parlor. I have a piece done by a great aunt of mine from Pennsylvania back in the 30s or 40s, I think. Behind my desk, I have a couple of woodcuts done by Neil Harrington, who is a Russellville, Arkansas artist.
Though not on his walls, Schaefer's favorite pieces in the collection are those by Carol Kloer, whose sketches and paintings depict life as he remembers it. Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art has some of his work. Also of note here, Crystal Bridges Museum has borrowed pieces from the Tyson collection. It's difficult to do this collection justice, which includes 25 photographs by Ansel Adams, works by Thomas Hart Benton, and sculptures by Ginger Henry Geyer. We've only seen what the flat building holds. There are two more towers that also contain art on this Springdale campus. Schaefer says they're trying to figure out a way to show it to the public, perhaps tours one day a month. As it is a place of business, people can't just wander around freely. It's for the Tyson team members to enjoy as they walk to their desks with their morning coffee or rush from one meeting to the next.
John just strongly believes that that exposing fine art to our team members and visitors, customers, vendors that come is important to cause them to think about things outside what goes on in this building, but also to encourage creativity and, you know, thinking about the big picture of where we are in the world. And everyone seems to enjoy it. Our team members, I think, are very proud of the collection.
The public will have one opportunity to get a closer look at Springdale's hidden treasure. Tomorrow at noon at the Shiloh Museum for Ozark History, Tyson Art Team member and curator Shannon Dillard Mitchell will give a slideshow. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Have you ever asked yourself, am I going crazy?
The notion is that if you see things or hear things, you're going mad. But as a physician, I have to try and define what's going on and to reassure people that they're not going insane.
I'm Guy Raz, the place between madness and sanity. It's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour, Sunday at noon on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle.
KUAF is supported by Penguin Ed's Barbecue, offering catering services for parties or events of any size at either location or one of the banquet rooms at the Mission and Weddington restaurants. Various catering packages available, penguineds.com.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Osage.
Osage in Carroll County. You were in Carroll County over the weekend?
I was.
Opera.
And Turpentine Creek, all that good stuff. Yeah.
Last Friday, I went to Arvis Ballpark to watch the Naturals play the Springfield Cardinals. I bring that up because the Naturals announced today that on August 29th, they will have Teacher Appreciation Night at Arvis Ballpark, and in attendance will be Dennis Haskins, someone that your generation probably knows. He played Mr. Belding on Saved by the Bell.
All right! So there you go.
He'll be there. I guess he's throwing out the first pitch.
Oh, fun! You know what? I remember he came, well, I was in college. He came to campus to speak.
Yes, that's right.
And yeah. I didn't make it because we had bad weather. It was icy and whatnot, and I had to get back to Rogers.
See, wait long enough, and Mr. Belding will come back. So,
this makes me very happy.
That'll be Teacher Appreciation Night.
Love it.
In Springdale. I also wanted to mention Sunday afternoon I went to see the play that we did the Start to Finish series on.
Yeah.
B-Side Myself.
How was that?
It was very good. It was at George's Full House. On a Sunday afternoon.
Great.
Full house. So the next incarnation, we'll see. We'll follow what happens next.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
You and I back together tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
For another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large.
Mm-hmm.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
My name is Renee Grajeda.
Thanks so much for listening.
And have a very happy Tuesday.